Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. I am Reggie Darden, and today I have another wonderful guest with me today. I got Mr. Frank Soto, and we're going to get into his journey in Kenpo and martial arts, and whatever other items that we decide to chat about today, we'll get into that as well. So I usually kick things off with just giving a quick rundown of my background. I started in the early to mid 90s at a Chinese Kenpo school, essentially that of the Tracy's curriculum. Started there and started because of the movie The Perfect Weapon with Jeff Speakman. And I loved the journey and going through that. And over the years, I have trained in some other arts, capoeira being the other, I guess, core art that I've done. But I also have ranks in hapkido and taekwondo. I did some boxing. Also training in American Kenpo and recently started doing some Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So been around the block a little bit, and we may get into more of my story as we go along, but let's turn it over to Mr. Soto here, and tell me and the listeners how did Kenpo find you? How did the martial arts find you? Where did it all start? And we'll go from there.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for inviting me to this podcast. Really nice of you. It's an honor to be here. And I started Kenpo back in 94. I started in martial arts in 84 when I was a kid. But I started Kenpo back in 94 with a local Kenpo school who was under the guidance of Mr. Gilbert Velez. There were a couple of students of him here. And then a couple of years later, I went to Pasadena to learn Kenpo from Grandmaster Larry Tatum. He became my instructor, and I got basically all my Kenpo knowledge from him.
Oh, very nice, very nice. Yeah, my current Kenpo instructor got his third and fourth from Larry Tatum. So
nice.
So very nice. So what was it that got you involved in it? So for me, I've always been interested in the martial arts, and growing up watching the Bruce Lee movies and Jackie Chan movies and all of that sort of thing. And once I finally kind of got the opportunity and the green light to start training, that's what I started. But what was the driving factor for getting you involved?
Well, I started martial arts because my father took me to a karate lesson when I was a kid, because I was being bullied by, kids in school. I was a nice, little bit shy kid. That's why I started it. But I guess we all have a martial arts role model or kind of a hero, right? For me, it wasn't Bruce Lee. It was actually the old Kung Fu TV series with Wai Chan Kane. That was it. I wanted to be, when I was a kid, I wanted to be this cool monk who had a great philosophy of life, but also could kick butt,
Oh, yeah.
And basically, that kind has been my goal ever since. Be good, defending myself and protecting my family, whatever, but also to have a correct way of life, not just the way of the fist, meaning not just fighting, but also the philosophy of the fist. So the code of ethics, all of that kind of stuff, it's very important. And it all started because of that TV series.
Very nice.
So that's what it did it for me.
Very nice. And so that first school that you went to, was Was that a Kenpo school, or was that a different system? Or?
No. I started Korean karate, they call it here, which was a type of, kind of like Tangsudo. It was Hidokwan Korean style. It was in between Tangsudo and Taekwondo. Mm-hmm. Then that was mid-80s. So when we got to the 90s, we got all the Steven Seagal movies and all those movies. And I did a little bit of boxing when I was in high school. And I was looking for, I liked the Korean style, but I felt that I needed to use more of my hands. So I saw the Steven Seagal movies, and I wanted to move my hands full and fast like Steven Seagal did back in the, Above the Law and all those type of films. So I started taking a course with a friend here, and they took me to this Kenpo school because they shared space there with the Kenpo guy. And they told me, well, you can go here and, you know, sign up for Kenpo. They said very nicely, oh, they have some good stuff, you know. they were jiu-jitsu guys and a little bit of Aikido. So I thought it was, Kenpo was the sword. Didn't know what Kenpo was at all. Thought it was Kendo. So I got there and I saw this guy wearing, you know, a black gi. And I remember it was actually a friend of mine from school who was there. I saw him and he was doing five swords. Oh, I don't know what's that, but I want that. That's cool. I like that. You know, I wanted to use my hands. So I got hooked with Kenpo. And then I think it was a couple of months later, I lived in close to the border with close to Tucson, Arizona. I live in Mexico. So I went to Tucson to Gilbert Velez school, Mr. Gilbert Velez, and I got the first two books of the Infinite Insight series, Volume 1, Volume 2. And when I read that, I was like, whoa, this is it. This is the thing. Because it has, you know, has a why, it has a backup. I was actually in college at the time, and I was studying industrial engineers. So it made sense for me. The physical principles, you know, physics, mathematics, all that, engineering principles behind motion. So that's why, I guess, Kenpo became a calling, and eventually I dropped school to go to Pasadena to learn from the man, you know, from Larry, which for me was the top Kenpo instructor at the time, with all respect to all the other guys, of course. Mm-hmm. This was just my opinion. And I went to him because I got a hold of one of his When Kenpo Strikes Panther production videos, the old VHS.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw him move, and I was like, whoa, this is the guy. This is it. I want to learn from this man. So I went to Pasadena, and I actually stayed there for a while. It was a little over a year back in 97, 98. By the time I got there, I was already a brown belt, so I got my black belt, and I came back here and opened up my studio. Made Kenpo not just profession, but my way of life.
Very nice. Very nice. I like that. Now, did you always want to getting to the teaching side of it, or did that come later? Or?
No. At the beginning, I just wanted to learn. You know, like I said, I was in college. I was studying to become an engineer, so I was thinking about a different type of profession, right? The regular type, I guess, the standard one. You know, you go to college, you graduate, and then you go to work. When I got a hold of Kenpo, it touched me. You know, it touched me. I guess it sounds a little bit corny, but it touched my spirit, basically. It moved me from the inside, and I knew I had to pursue it. And then when I saw what it was all about, when I got the books, when I met Mr. Tatum, I started teaching. I wanted to teach. Then it just became a way of life. When I went to Pasadena and I saw what Mr. Tatum had, his studio, Old Town Pasadena on Green Street, it was just amazing. The environment, people, the business was good also. So I said, I can make a living out of this, you know, and also be around cool people and have, I want this. but I want to create it, right? So I went with the best, like I said, and I didn't just learn tempo. I also learned how to manage business, because that's also very important if you dojo. So I did that. I basically managed Mr. Tatum's studio for a while because I wanted to learn. It wasn't like a regular or, you know, a title position. I just wanted to learn. So I tried to take care of everything while I was there to learn. And by the time I got my black belt, I felt I was ready. So I came back here and opened up a studio. And I did very good, actually. Back in 98, I opened up a studio, and a year later, I had almost 150 students lined up, taking lessons.
Very nice. Very nice. Now, before we get on or continue on the Kenpo side of it, on that the Korean style that you were training in, did you kind of ever, well, I should say when you got involved in Kenpo, did you kind of jettison the Korean stuff, or were you still kind of cross training? And
I got pretty far into Korean style, but I never felt I was a good kicker. I'm 5'11". I'm tall enough, but I'm like my legs are a little bit shorter than my upper body, I guess. So I can kick pretty hard. Weights level, you know, I could kick up to the head, but I never liked it. I thought I was exposed. And actually, when we did sparring back in the Pasadena on Green Street Studio, on Larry's studio, you raise the leg and they will kick you in the groin, basically, you know, the Kenpo way. So kicking was never, you know, kicking to the face was never my thing. I mean, I've seen a lot of great guys doing that, and they're amazing. I respect that, and they can be very dangerous. For me, it was more the hands. That's why I mentioned at the beginning, I wanted to learn how to use my hands. And also, when you are raised here in a small Mexican city, you are exposed to violence. You are very little. Streets are rough. Kids are rough in school. I was never a problem child, but I would fight at least once every school year, at least. And I was one of the kids that never fought, basically. So that should tell you something. Everybody had to fight there. It was a different era, I guess, too, back in the 80s. So I like the Korean style. I think it's good. But I also never focused on tournament sparring and stuff like that. My main focus was self-defense. And I also got involved with the police. I'm a police instructor now. I'm certified now, but I started teaching police back in the 90s as well. So it was a different focus, where high kicks were not the main thing to use. Police officers don't kick to the head either, right? Wouldn't be good for them, and especially if they're on camera doing a spinning, flying back, you know, or hook kick or something on a civilian, that wouldn't be okay. So I've seen guys, you know, my former Kenpo instructors and fellows, they did blend their Korean style with Kenpo, and I think they did pretty well. It's a good compliment. I think it is. If you're like an American Kenpo guy and you have all these techniques that are more focused on using hands, and you add the good, you know, kicking from a Taekwondo or a Korean style, I think it will enhance your Kenpo a lot, give you way more options.
Yeah, no, I agree. Having the cross training. So at my first school, my instructor had a bit of a Taekwondo background. So as far as Kenpo schools went, we were a lot more proficient in kicking than kind of your typical Kenpo schools. And so I've always been a big fan of kicking and it's important to have all those be able to work in the different ranges and have those different tools to utilize. So yeah, I'm in agreement with that. So can you go ahead and talk a little bit about your days training with Mr. Tatum? And what was that like? Any particular standout moments that come to mind, or stories sure. Come to mind?
Well, like I said, I was there. I started training with him in '96. I would go back and forward every couple of months. Then by May of '97, I stayed there. Tatum said, "Why don't you stay here?" Cool. I was in college, so it was the end of May. We had like our summer vacation, whatever, in college. So I went there to stay for the summer. And while I was there, he said, "Well, you should stay here." Yes, yes. So I went back home and told my parents, "I'm out of college." My dad didn't took it very well, but I did. And one of the things that I did is I struck a good deal with Mr. Tatum, because when I was there for summer, for summertime, said, "Come here, you know, I'll help you out, and I'll give you $100 a week." This was back in '97, right? And so I saved some money. Said, "Wow, I mean, I was paying for tuition, right? I was paying for lessons." But then he said, "You can come here, help me teach," you know, because he had a lot of instructors under him teaching at the studio, "and I will pay you some money." So I saved some money. So I got there and stayed there for almost 2 months. And at the end, I said, "Well, sir, thank you very much for this. This was amazing. I had to go back." And then he said, "Well, why don't you stay here until, you know, the end of the year?" So I said, "I can't afford it." He said, "Well, no, I'll pay you. I'll pay you $250 a week." That was like minimum wage. I said, "Cool, yeah, but..." I was bold. Like, I said, "But yes, but I'll do it if you give me... if you include me in my payment, one private lesson with you, an hour lesson a week." And he put on a big smile and said, "Okay, I'll do that." So while I was there, I was getting a private lesson once a week from the man. Also, I was there from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. every day, teaching, training. And that's when my Kenpo got good, solid. Because there were all these black belts, really good guys, amazing athletes at Kenpo. I remember William Glenn was there, Michael Bagwell was there, Clyde O'Brien was there, Jennifer Chang, Cliff Seminario, James Leonard, Manny Shikarchi, Scott Higgins was there. So all these guys were at my level, most of them were higher belts. They helped me a lot. We used to run, you know, tempo cards, so run the techniques, and also did a lot of sparring. And it was really good. And every Wednesday we had an advanced class with Mr. Tatum also. The advanced class was tough. I remember, every Wednesday, the group class will start at 7 p.m. And then at 7:30, Mr. Tatum will split the class and leave the beginners in one side of the studio and the advanced on the other side. So every Wednesday around 6:30, we will sit on the bench there at the studio. And I'm tired, man. I don't think I'm going to go into class today, and fear started kicking in because it was tough. I mean, we will go at it, hit each other hard. So it's like, and then Mr. Tatum will come and look at us, put on a big smile, and say, "You ready for class?" "Yes, sir, we are, of course." So we go into class, with a lot of, with a little bit of fear, sometimes a lot of fear, especially if there was the big guys there that were going to beat the crap out of you. But then the moment you start class, the next 30 seconds or a minute, when you start moving, you forget, you just go for it, and you enjoyed it a lot. So we did that. That was an amazing class. It was very good training. Like I said, very skillful practitioners. Kempo is training with you, so you're going to get good no matter what, because you're in good company. They will demand the best of you. So that made a difference. Mr. Tatum teaching, he was very into the details, for example, of form, like, let's do a form, long form three. So I'm doing the form. They're good, but no, move this, move that. He was, oh, very good. Do it again. Great. Do it again. So that really helped. I went through the whole curriculum with him that year. Back then, I also had a very good memory, and had ability to learn all the material fast. Could retain a lot of knowledge. Not anymore. Now I'm 52, and my mind doesn't work the same, but I used to. So we had good moments. A lot of people used to come in from different places to train with Mr. Tatum. So it was all good. It was good times.
Very nice, very nice. Now, you mentioned before, I meant to kind of ask about this a little bit earlier, but the you didn't do much competing at all, or did that kind of come up at all? Tournaments and things like that.
When I was a kid, when I was doing the Korean style, I went into a tournament when I think I was like 13. I went into this tournament. I was a white belt. I was 12 still. I went into this tournament. The tournament was from another school. We were like a very tiny school, like 12 of us. We went into this tournament, and I got into this, my first fight, and I remember I was fighting this other kid, and the other kid was from the school that was running the tournament, right? So all the judges were from his school and everything. And I remember fighting this kid, and I lost 3-0, points bar, right? And I was very, very, very upset, because at least I hit him twice. So I didn't have a problem with losing. I mean, it was okay. It was my first tournament. I lost. It's a big deal. But I had a problem with people not giving me at least one score that I did hit, right? So at that moment, I said, I'm never coming back into BS again. I was a very, emotional kid, I guess. I got really pissed. I'm like, just start cursing everybody and left. And from that moment on, I never did tournament sparring in any tournament. But what I did do was forms and self-defense. Because it was for me, away from me, when also, especially when I already had my own dojo, my own studio, every time we went to a tournament and did competition, my students did compete a little bit. We also got students from them. Always. Every time we went, we at least got a couple of students that see us in the tournament and will go to the studio. So it was a good way, you know, for marketing and to showcase your skill, I guess. But I went into the International Karate Championship back in 96 and 97. I was, a green belt, 96 and 97. I was a brown belt, and I got first place in self-defense and second place in kata. And in kata, it was a huge category. There was like 30 or 40 of us. And I got this girl beat me. She had very nice kata. I don't remember who it was, but so I got second place. I think I did long form three. And then next year I did self-defense. I got first place. So I can say I'm an IKC champion.
I like it. Yeah, no, I didn't do much competing. I mean, could probably count. Well, you could definitely count on one hand how many tournaments I was in, and pretty sure I got disqualified on every single one, because you know, I was used to in our in-school sparring classes, we would hit to the head and and everything, and you know, kick to the groin and stuff like that. And I know I would like to do back fist, like a back fist to the head, and then a reverse punch to the body. And I would do that at the tournament, and they're like, "Oh no, you can't hit to the head, or you can't hit to the face." And so I'd get the warning, or get deducted a point or something like that, and be like, "Okay, I'm not going to do that." But just that muscle memory would take over, and I'd see this big shiny melon there, ready to be hit. So I would go and throw that combination again, and sure enough, it's like, "No, you can't do that. You're out." And so I didn't get much of a taste for the tournaments. I would go and support my teammates and everything, but I just didn't compete myself. And then I never did the competed in the forums. I sometimes toy with the idea of maybe trying it now, just to kind of say I did it, but I don't know. We'll see. So that, and then also I didn't get to, I wasn't high enough ranked to do the forms that I wanted to do. So that was another thing that kind of kept me from doing that. But, I don't know. We'll see. And then, I remember going to internationals. I think it was probably 94 or 95. And I remember that there was a lot of ill feelings towards the judges. Apparently the judging was just really, 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 really bad that year. And I seem to remember a big fight breaking out and just people just everywhere, just big melee. I kind of think of the end of Enter the Dragon, and everybody's kind of fighting for their lives there. Our guys, we said, "Oh, well, we made this long drive up here, but we're not sticking around for this." So once it got pretty nasty, we were out of there. But the tournament stuff is it's a mixed bag. But I think it's worthwhile to at least try it out a time or two. But
sure,
everybody's got their thing. So so let's move to when you opened up your school. I'm sure that was probably pretty scary, but exciting, and as well. And kind of how did that go when you started that?
Well, I was actually, it was more exciting than anything else. I was young. I was like 25 when I opened up my first commercial dojo back in '98, June of '98, I had the support of my parents, actually. Eventually, my mother always supported me. My dad was like, "Okay, whatever. As long as you can, make a business, make a living out of it." So I opened the studio up, and like I said, I did very well. I did a lot of promotion back in the days, Yellow Pages, local TV, local radio, put ads there. And Kempo, even though there was another Kempo school, they never advertised it as Kempo until I opened up my dojo. They advertised it as Korean because they were more focused on tournaments. I was the first Kempo school who was focused on self-defense, the art, the whole curriculum and all the American Kempo stuff. Here, I opened up here in Hermosillo. That's where I'm at. So I stay here for a couple of years. Let's see, from 98 until 2002. Then I decided to move to Mexico City to open up a dojo there and start teaching. And I did. And I also had big success there. I got into the main TV station, the national TV, which is Televisa, with a self-defense capsule in one of the shows. I also got involved with Martial Arts Magazine, which was the name, Artes Marciales, in Spanish. We did good there as well. So I stayed there for 5 years. And then I came back because I was already married and we got pregnant with our third kid. It was hard to raise three kids in Mexico. Mexico City can be tough. So we came back here and I've been here ever since. I got more involved with the police. I still teach. I have my dojo here. And I got involved in other arts as well. When I was in Mexico City, I started learning. That's when I got in touch also in Mexico City with Ed Parker Jr. I called him and I invited him to seminars. So he did there a couple of times, two or three times. I'm not quite sure. And then he introduced me to the Toilo Zengas, who are the founders of Malama.
Oh, very nice.
Sister Art Temple, right? Tino Toilo Zenga was a close friend of Mr. Parker and a student. And I met Mr. Tino, also met his son, Rudy. And they made me a part of their martial family, basically, under the request of Mr. Parker Jr., because of course, their family, basically. So I learned Lima Lama art as well. And that actually improved my Kenpo a lot, because they are more into flowing hands.
Mm-hmm.
And my Kenpo that I learned from Tatum was more... Mr. Tatum uses a lot of tension when he moves. I mean, he moves amazing. He's the man. But that was hurting a little bit in my joints. I had some arthritis problem back then. So I started doing the Lima Lama stuff, the hands, and that really helped me a lot. And it changed the way I do Kenpo, the way I move now. And also I got involved with Ed Parker Jr. and I created my thesis, which is the Connecticut program. And I did that and I got Mr. Parker Jr. involved in it because he was doing what he called alternative solutions back then. And then eventually he moved on and he created his factual arts, which I think he's doing very well with it. And I stay with my Connecticut stuff and also Kenpo. I always love Kenpo and I still do. And I think Kenpo is, for me, one of the best martial art out there, of course, for me, my opinion. Like I said, I don't criticize anybody and I like all the other arts, but that's the art that I practice. And within the Kenpo that I do, my thesis as a black belt in Kenpo, I call it Connecticut. And the Connecticut stuff is more, Kenpo is basically black and white. You have peace mode and war mode. That's it. That's all you have in Kenpo. Whether you're in peace or you're at war, right? So you're avoiding fights. You're in peaceful, you know, self, like, oh, yeah, no, I don't want any problems. And until you don't have any other choice, and then you unleash hell with a Kenpo technique. You hit the guy 20 times in 3 seconds, right? So with Connecticut, I started exploring Connecticut under the idea of passive Kenpo of Mr. Parker Jr. And then from there, I also got to study a little bit of the Russian Sistema stuff. I think there's a lot of value in some of that stuff. Also the Lima Lama stuff, and also the use of force, because I was learning police tactics. And all of that goes into what I teach. And the main difference with my thesis in Kenpo is that with Connecticut, you can explore the shades of gray, meaning you're not using Kenpo, whether people like it or not. Kenpo is based upon the use of violence, basically, because it's an ancient art. It comes from the Chinese that went into the Japanese had it for 800 years, and then it came to America under the hand of James Masayoshi Mitose, then William Chow, then Mr. Parker. And the Tracys learned from Mr. Parker and so on. So Kenpo, it's based upon the use of violence, right? That's why there's only black and white, because back in the days, back in, the 1600s or the 1500s in Japan, that's where Kenpo was from, they didn't have this, I'm gonna be nice to you, I'm gonna just put them some handcuffs or whatever. If you encounter a thing like this, you have to survive, so it was kill or be killed, basically. That's what it was, right? So I'm not saying Kenpo is like that today, but it's still the foundation. The foundation of the art is the use of violence. Of course, it has to be controlled violence, and that's why you need to have a code of ethics, and you need to be, if not a good person, you need to be a correct, with a good sense of justice, basically. That's why the creed of Kenpo, I come to you with only karate and hands, right? When I did the Connecticut stuff, I said, well, I cannot use that model here, especially when I teach the police or civilians, because if you apply a technique, you have the risk of, exceeding your legit right for defending yourself, go into excessive defense, right, or excessive force, and you will get in problems with the law. So you use the model of the use of force, which is based upon principles, the principles of legality, necessity, accountability, and proportionality, right? And you use that model. So instead of using violence in Connecticut, we use force, right? We use that model. I mean, a civilian is not allowed to use force. That's exclusive for law enforcement. But you use the model, you apply it to self-defense, then you can have a way of defending yourself in a different, you're escalating, right? Instead of black and white, now you have those shades of grays. That's very important when you're going to teach self-defense to a civilian in a responsible way. Because, I heard this saying that a lot of people always say this, that it's better to be judged by 12 than to be carried by 6, right? You heard that, of course. So I don't believe in just two options. That's still black and white, right? You're judged by 12, so your jury is 12, or you're carried by 6, you're coffin, right? So you die or you go to jail. That's still black and white thinking. That's the way violence thinks, or a man who's in a survival mode, a fight or flight mode, thinks that way. But if you go beyond the fight or flight mode and you start, your training, and you become more strategic and more tactical in a way, then you'll see that there are more options, but you need to create those options. Okay, what if I'm not, I don't have to go to court and I'm not gonna die, and I can create another option for me to defend myself? Well, that's the logic behind my thesis of Connecticut. I still apply a lot of the Kenpo stuff, but I apply it in a different scenario because it's not always a life or death situation. Actually, if you go into the statistics, you're going to realize that most of the stuff that you're going to encounter are not life or death. Maybe once in your lifetime will you be in a life or death situation. So what about the rest? What about, somebody, you're in a party with your friends, and a friend of yours gets violent and starts pushing you. What are you going to do? Are you going to, do 5 swords on him and then take him down, do leap of death and break his neck? Because that's all the options you have. So that doesn't mean that 5 swords or leap of death doesn't work. It means that's not the context to use those, right? So I look for different things, and that's how I ended up doing what I do. And also understanding the history of Kenpo, which was also another thing that I've been doing. I've been looking for, and I found it, basically. I was looking for the source. Where does Kenpo come from? Because we hear all these stories, and I found it. I found the source. Actually, I wrote a book in Spanish, though. Not in English yet, but of the Kenpo origins. And by knowing the history of Kenpo, where it came from, what's the history behind it, it was not created by just one man. That's not true. It was designed actually by two guys, by Mr. Parker and his sensei. But Kenpo, it's been around for hundreds and thousands of years. Kenpo has been around for hundreds of years. Chanfa, another 800 plus years. And then before that, there was another art, so which is the same lineage. Our art basically comes from India to China to Japan, from Japan to Hawaii and the mainland, the rest of the world. So if you understand the story and the way it works and you understand where Kenpo comes from, also you get all these doubts that you might have about Kenpo, because I still see and hear a lot of that. Kenpo techniques don't work on the street, and they were not created for that, and blah, 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 all this stuff. That's all wrong. That's not true. Kenpo works amazingly. It's designed for battle, not just for the street. It's designed for survival and for battle. And yes, you can apply a whole Kenpo technique, the whole technique, by the book, in a fight. The thing is, Kenpo is not the problem. The problem is the student, the practitioner, who hasn't learned the art properly. Maybe because he wasn't taught well, we were not taught well, I don't know. Maybe because you didn't train well, right? But instead of blaming the art, which I did for a while, I got to confess. But instead of blaming the art, if you find out what's going on and you go and look for the answers and you find the answers, then you realize that, wow, this art is just amazing. And if you're not making it work, then you better train harder, train properly, and focus on making it work. And it will work for you, because it's, for me, is the most effective, potentially effective, because it depends on the student, of course, science of combat or combat science in any art form or any martial arts that we have access to right now. Kenpo, way more than any other art. And I'm sorry about the other arts. And I know there are a lot of good practitioners out there, don't get me wrong. And I know I can get my ass whooped and kicked by any, any practitioner, because it's about the individual. But if you see of in the technology of motion, if you see of the science behind the art, is the most advanced by far, Kenpo. That's just my opinion, again.
Yeah, I like it. I always kind of laugh at the argument of, oh, well, this style doesn't work in the street, or this technique doesn't work. And I laugh at that, because if something didn't work, I don't think people would want to continue training in it, continue teaching it. And this is not just for Kenpo, but just in all of the various martial arts. If there wasn't some value to it, or if it didn't work, people would stop teaching it. There are arts that have died out over the years, and for one reason or another. But the ones that work and do the things that they claim that they can do are passed on. People want to continue to pass those on. So. I agree with you in that it is on the student, the person that's using it is going to make that, is going to make it, work or not. We're given the principles, we're given the concept, the blueprints for these things to work, and it's up to us to make them work in a real scenario, fit it to, tailor it to our bodies, our abilities, our experiences, and we're the ones that make it work, and it's not the art itself. And even looking at Kenpo, just over the years, it has evolved and changed, and the things that don't work, quote unquote don't work, are removed out of the art or revised, or it's constantly growing and changing, and so yeah, it's not a thing where this doesn't work. So yeah, I always kind of have a laugh at that little argument, but yeah, I like it. I like what you got going there. And so, one next kind of thing I wanted to touch on. My understanding, you have a YouTube channel or a show or podcast.
That's right. Yes, sir. Coffee and Martial Arts. Well, Coffee and Martial Arts started back in 2020 when we were in a lockdown. Basically, before that, I did, you know, YouTube videos. Video, edited and put it out there. But then in 2020, when we were in a lockdown, one day I was teaching at the police academy. The next day I was out of a job, basically. Home, sitting down, and like, what the heck? What am I going to do now? Right? And I think it was a month, maybe a couple of months into the pandemic and the lockdown. I told my wife, what am I going to do now? I can't do YouTube videos because I need my sparring partner, right? And she said, well, why don't you do a live streaming? What? yeah, streaming. I was like, okay, I have no idea how to do that. But I'll teach you. She was sat down and we started on Facebook, okay? And said, well, this is what you're going to do. You're going to get a cup of coffee. I love coffee. Okay. So I got a big mug of coffee, right? And then you're just going to talk. Whatever subject you want to talk. You always want to talk about martial arts, right? So coffee and talking about martial arts doesn't get any better. So you're just going to talk to people, drink your coffee. And once your coffee is done, you finish the transmission. Okay, cool. I like that. So I sat down, I had my coffee, and I started talking. I basically did 25 minutes to 30 minutes because, you know, talking and drinking coffee, take your time. And oddly enough, people liked that. I guess everybody was in front of their computer. So I started getting views and people commenting and stuff. And then eventually one of my Kenpo friends said, why don't, would you mind if I go into your, you know, into your show? I'm like, oh, now it's a show. Okay, cool. I like that. Okay, sure. So I invited him. I think my first one, Coffee and Martial Arts, was Maestro Scott Higgins. Salute to Mr. Higgins. And we did that. And then, you know, from there on, people wanted to be on my show. So I started interviewing people. And then from being a monologue, me drinking coffee, it became this platform where I got to interview a lot of very important martial artists, Kenpo guys, and also jiu-jitsu guys and other arts. You know, I got to interview a UFC fighter. I got close to interview Mike Tyson. It didn't happen, but I was close to interview Mike Tyson, and I also got offered to interview Jason Statham. Never happened either, but it was like, wow. It all started with me having a cup of coffee in front of the freaking camera and talking. So I got to interview Horion Gracie and his sons. I got to interview, Alexa Grasso, which is a UFC champion. A lot of the Kenpo seniors. I also got to interview Mr. Bill Wallace.
Oh, very nice.
So big names. And all came out of, you know, I interview somebody and they will say, would you like to interview such and such? Oh, yes, of course. Bring them on. So, and the show got views. I did it in Spanish and English, both formats. And we have people watching all over the place, you know, people commenting, and they really like the format. So I still do it. I don't do as many interviews as I did because it got to a point that it was really, really demanding, and I had to go back to work, right? It was, for me, this was a hobby. But It got to a point that I was going live every day, at least once a day, from Monday to sometimes from Monday to Sunday. Did an hour show in the morning, sometimes an hour show in the afternoon. It got really, really busy, and then I just said, okay, this is good. I'm not making profit. I guess I didn't know how to make money out of it. I shouldn't have. But now I still have the show once a week or maybe twice, and we still have a lot of viewers. It's been amazing because, well, I got to learn a lot from all the guests, basically. Take the time, I guess, you know, that happens to you as well. If you take the time to listen to people, to what they got to say, there's always something you can learn from them. And I got to meet very amazing and notorious individuals through this platform. I'm grateful.
Very nice. Yeah, no, I'm definitely going to go back and check out your episodes there, and definitely giving me some more inspiration. I can totally relate to, I started this show and it's like, oh, you know, I'm going to get to talk to my buddies and stuff, but you know, not really much else. Maybe down the road I'll get lucky and I'll get, you know, a big name to be on. And kind of right out of the gate, I had a lot of the Kempo seniors agree to be on, and I've got to talk to quite a few so far, and got some more lined up in the future, and then got some celebrities already on, and some signed up to be on soon. So yeah, it's really exciting, and I really am thankful for this you know, medium and the technology and things that we're able to do these sorts of things now. And you know, I never would have imagined that, you know, I would get to talk to Ed Parker Jr. or Jeff Speakman, or you know, a lot of these people, and you know, just kind of thanks to the pandemic too, the people are open to you know, be on these Zoom calls and things like that, and yeah, I've just been really, really thankful and exciting that that we get to connect with each other all over the world, and share the stories and share that knowledge and all of that. So very cool. All right, so we are going to move into our lightning round here. Just got a few little questions as we head towards wrapping up here. The first question being, do you have a favorite technique?
Was that favorite technique?
Yes.
Thundering hammers.
Ah, very nice, very nice. That's one of the Kempo All-Stars, I call it, a technique that you kind of find in every version of Kempo out there. Got to have your thundering hammers and your five swords and ones like that. So I like it. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Favorite form five.
Okay. Very nice.
And set. Striking set.
I'm sorry. What was that?
Striking set.
Striking set. Oh, yes. Good. 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 I like those. I like them. Very good. All right. Do you have a favorite weapon?
Sure. Sticks. Kempo clubs.
Nice. Nice. I like it. I like it. Have you done any kind of Kali
screaming? A little bit. Yeah. But I believe more in Kempo than Kali.
Okay.
It's different. It's not the same. I think Kempo, still a lot to explore there, but can be even more lethal, I guess.
Gotcha.
Because I'm a Kempo guy. So if you use your Kempo platform and you add the weapons, the possibilities are endless. So, oh, yeah. But I do like Kali. I think it's amazing, of course.
Very nice. Very nice. I like it. All right. The next question, is there... If there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
Okay. Mr. Parker, Japanese sensei named Sean Komatsu. That's his name. That's in my book, actually. That's the guy I would have loved to meet. Gone now.
Very nice. Very nice. I like it. All right. So now we are at our point for a shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything that you'd like, or if there's anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to get out there, you have the floor, and then we will close out from there.
You can look me up in social media. I'm in Instagram, Facebook, YouTube as Master Frank Soto. That's my marketing name, Master Frank Soto. Please call me Frank. I have coffee and martial arts. I have videos available as well of the art. I do seminars and stuff. This year, I think I'm going to be in New Jersey, probably around September. Going to Europe, to Belgium and Germany in October. Going down to Chile in November. Pretty much it, I think. I have some national travels here in Mexico, students. And when I get my book in English, I will put it in Amazon in a digital format so people can buy it, Kenpo Origins. Three series. I just finished my first book and it's already published. And I have two more to go. And it's about the history, the untold, side of the history that hasn't been told. And I have to say this. Every time that more information comes out, it doesn't invalidate the previous complement. Because history, it's like a huge river with a lot of fishes in it. So each fish that it's in under that river has a different story to tell. That's what complicates things in history. It's never just one side of the story. There's so many lines in history you can explore, and they're probably all going to be correct in a way. Because right now, a lot of things are happening in the world at this very moment. And we cannot say that we have the whole truth because it's never like that. So in Kenpo, it happens the same. So there's a side of Kenpo, the history of the art, the way that the curriculum was created. There's a story, a part of the history and the story of Mr. Parker that hasn't been told. It's building on this book. I have an anonymous source that gave me all this information. I wasn't there. Please don't kill the messenger. So I'm just the one putting it out there. But I think I did the book because I think a lot of people can benefit from it, as I did. Benefit a lot from this book, from this information, basically. That's why I put it in a book. It changed the way I perceived Kenpo. Gave me the clarity of mind that I needed. Calm my heart and my soul, because I was troubled for a while with the art and the origins. It doesn't work. This doesn't that. All that yes was in my head. Gone now, because knowing where it comes from, knowing what it's based upon, knowing that the Kenpo techniques are hundreds, some of them thousands of years old. They were not created back in the 60s. That's not true. Some of them were formulated. It's not the same. To formulate a technique is not the same as creating a technique. Like, for example, let me just add this. Technique Five Source, it has been around Kenpo and Chuanfa for over 2,000 years. A different name, same technique. So, and it's been used in battle for many, many occasions. That's why Kenpoists love this technique. They don't know why. We don't know why, but we love Five Source, right? Everybody loves Five Source. Well, that's because Five Source has over 90% of success statistic behind it. 90% of effectiveness. So if you use five swords in a fight properly, we'll have more than 90% rate of success applying that technique. And that's in a statistic. That's the way Kenpo was created. It is based upon statistics of hundreds of years old, numbers behind it. The fact that we don't know them doesn't mean that they didn't exist. So basically, that's what it is. And I also wanted to thank you, sir. Thank you so much for this. I hope you have way more success than you're already having. I wish you the best. I know you're in a great journey because I'm in the same path, in a parallel one, parallel history. See it? I'm another fish in the river doing my thing. So thank you again. And thank you for all the listeners. I hope this message helps a little bit. I wish you the best, everybody that's listening.
All right. Well, yes, thank you so much for being on. I can't wait to get this out to everyone to hear. And I'll make sure to put links and everything for all your channels and stuff and what you're doing in the show notes. And just thank you again for taking the time to tell me your story. And we'll close out for today. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Good day.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.